Welcome to Word on the Street, a weekly podcast from Barclays where our experts help ordinary investors make sense of the latest news and events impacting the world's financial markets.
Welcome back to Word on the Street. So the big shock of the week was inflation, which is clearly, as ever, grabbing the headlines and has put the cat back amongst the pigeons, I think it's fair to say, particularly looking at bond markets with probabilities shifting around here and there. So Will and I today will take a look at how that impacts the team's views, both on the economy and obviously also the upcoming November election, which draws ever nearer given the importance of inflation and interest rates to voters. So, Will, let's kick off with inflation data. As I said, front of mind, this is not a story that's going away anywhere anytime soon, it seems. The expectation was that we should see further evidence of, you know, potentially it softening a little bit. We did literally just have the US producer price index come in. That seemed to be slightly below expectations. But then CPI, consumer price index yesterday, that seemed to be a little bit more problematic, didn't it?
Miles, you said it all again. Like, you don't need me at all. We can just have a solo podcast with you going through it all.
I know you're going to say, don't get too excited about decimal places.
Yeah, oh, no, you know that. You know it. You know it. Yes. But I mean, I think the point that we would make about yesterday's, and the narrative changes again a little bit subtly today, but yesterday's consumer price inflation, most people were looking at it, hoping that it would sort of confirm this kind of disinflationary story that people have been, you know, if you look at the chart for inflation in the US, the UK and Europe, you'll see this kind of hump just peaking in sort of 2023 and then just sharply downwards. And what it seems like is whether you smooth it or you chop up bits of it and look at some parts of it, or however you cut it up, that the sort of trends in disinflation in the US seem to have stalled for a little bit. So you're finding those price pressures have kind of leveled out a little bit above the Federal Reserve's target, just too much above for them to be sort of relaxed about it. Again, like ignoring the decimal places and so on and so on. But yes, there's probably enough in the CPI report to sort of say, maybe we won't get an interest rate cut in June. And then today, the producer price inflation, I mean, interpreting all this, you can get quite wonky, and I'm going to avoid that, obviously. But what people were looking at is because the two different inflation reports, CPI and PCE, we talked about this before, there's some differences in the component parts, and there's quite a wedge between the two about what they're sort of saying about inflation at the moment. So some people are looking at the aspects of the producer price inflation report and saying, well, actually, although CPI looked a bit toppy, PCE may look a little bit less worrying, so therefore, you know, you're hedging your bets. Don't get too involved in it. I think, you know, I mean, if you can afford to lose lots of hair, sure. But in reality, I'm not sure it's going to change, you know, in a way, like we've got teams dedicated to this kind of stuff. And if you're sort of sitting there looking at your multi-asset class fund or portfolio and you're a medium to long-term investor, which we hope you are,
Let them worry about it.
And already, just to give you an indication, you know, at the start of the year, you know, the market commentators and investors were all sort of, you know, getting ready for a, you know, in the US for an interest rate cutting bonanza starting in March, actually was kind of, you know, was penciled in. And obviously that narrative has changed substantially already this year.
It seems to be sort of market expectation September now, maybe.
Well, I mean, the problem you have a little bit is if you don't do it in June, then people are arguing that some of the data that's, or there's an absence of sort of really substantial data between then and September, and then you're starting to get quite close to November. And that's when, you know, any central bank is going to want to stay clear of the politics in a sense. So, you know, the argument then becomes, well, do you get an interest rate cut this year at all? If you don't get one in June, which seems like an odd thing, doesn't it? But I mean, what you can say is that the US economy is still kind of motoring along. It doesn't seem to be being slowed down by these interest rates, which is a bit of an anomaly, to be honest.
And if you look at, I suppose, how the bond markets reacted to all of this, I think the lovely word you used of me this morning was it's puked a bit.
Puked.
That was the word, wasn't it?
Yes, puked. Maybe I've seen too much.
But if you look at, I suppose if you look at, say, short-term borrowing costs in the US, look at, say, the two-year as an example, that's gone up, what, 0.5% over the past month? We're hovering just shy of 5%.
Maybe the obsession is puke. My son's a puker. So, yeah.
Charming.
Yeah, I know. We've had years of it. But Yes, I think the bond market did look quite rattled by yesterday. It settled a bit today again. And the problem you have for fixed income investors is several aspects, really. It's not just what's the Federal Reserve going to do with the sort of, you know, the policy rates over the course of the next 2 years, 3 years. You know, when I'm looking at a 10-year tenor, it's not only the sort of expected pass of interest rates over that time, but it's also, you know, if I'm going to lend to the government for 10 years and get my money locked up, essentially, then what I'm going to want compensation for is all the stuff like, will inflation surprise positively on that journey? Therefore, will I need more compensation to, you know, help digest that extra inflation, unexpected inflation? And so, you know, what you're finding is that it's not just the expected path of interest rates that are sort of changing. It's also people saying, well, if there's more inflation and it's going to be stickier for a while, then maybe longer yields need to be a bit higher to get me interested in lending to the government for that time frame anyway.
Got it. Right, I'm going to move on to politics, which you alluded to a little bit earlier. I know, dangerous game. It's not exactly surprising that, you know, inflation is one of the major issues for the upcoming election. I'm not going to hold you to anything, I promise.
Yes.
But does this change the path of probabilities at all in that respect?
Hard it's to certainly say. Dangerous. I mean, generally what you say is, you know, I mean, the oldest sort of rule, I mean, it goes back to the sort of famous Ms. Clinton aides campaign chairman, James Carville, I think it was, you know, the economy is stupid. And the idea is that, you know, ultimately voters, the closer you get to the election, it's the economy that really matters. And the most tangible aspect of the economy in some ways is not just the wages you receive, but the prices you pay.
Hey, yeah.
And in our heads, we don't have a firm idea of inflation. But when you go into the supermarket and you say, well, out of $100 or $10, I used to get this and now I get that. Now, in your head, you're thinking, you're comparing nominal with real to a certain degree. And so there's a miscalculation. But certainly, you know, what you tend to find in history is that on that economy piece, just to jump back a stage, you know, an incumbent president running for a second term with a strong economy, that's would tilt the odds significantly in your favor. This inflation story is interesting, though, because what you are seeing is that Americans generally still have quite a low opinion of, you know, President Biden's ability to manage the economy. If you look at the polls, and they're still quite downbeat on the economy. And there's been lots of questions about why this is and why aren't Americans, you know, seeing what everyone else seems to see, which is that the US economy is one of the best, most powerful, strongest in the world and doing the best out there. And the answers given really hinge on that story about inflation. And actually, it's not just the experience of inflation in the past, but what that tends to have is a lingering effect. And because if, like, you know, going back to that story about going into the supermarket, all I see is that I'm not seeing a moderating trend in inflation. I'm only seeing that prices are still going up. So I'm
look
still
at
paying.
Chocolate.
Yeah, chocolate. Exactly. Or fried chicken. You know my obsession there. And what you're seeing is that I'm just paying a bigger price for it. Not that the rate of change in that price is slowing down. Of course, I'm not noticing that. And so to a certain extent, this is going to be an important battleground in the elections. What I would say, though, and what we would say is there was quite an interesting study. I was looking at just it was out in December. If anyone gets in contact on LinkedIn, I can send it on. Looking at asset markets and political risk. And this is obviously particularly relevant at the moment. And what it's looking at is kind of during the past, looking at, you know, how measured political risk has evolved and how markets have tried to compensate for that, if at all. Now, what you're going for here, and again, just to sort of go back to basics a little bit, you know, this hinges a little bit on the idea or the question, why would I take a risk if there wasn't a commensurate return? And as you know, this is at the sort of at the basis for all asset pricing, essentially.
Basic logic, really, isn't
it? Yeah, it's basic logic. And there's huge amounts of theory around this. This, you know, the efficient markets idea, which is really that, you know, that all these risks are somehow weighed, counted, so on. And that actually, in order to sort of get entice someone in to lend to a government or to buy a stock and own it, that the expected return from that investment contains some compensation adequate in the buds of market.
For the risk you're taking.
For the risk you're taking. Now, what these guys have done, these academics, is they've looked at measures of political risk and they've used it to try and explain missing bumps in, you know, expected returns. And they've done so relatively successfully. And so the argument is that actually you are compensated for risk political risk included, and that the conclusion I think you would draw is be careful of trying to second guess and, you know, therefore, like, I need to disinvest from this because I think this president or that person, that central banker is going to come in. To a certain extent, that may already be factored into asset prices in an efficient world.
Got it. Okay. And then moving back to, I suppose, the economy, so slightly away from politics again.
Yeah.
How has that inflation data, those pushback interest rate expectations changed what I'm sure is a huge variety of paths? Are those scenarios changing at all? I mean, one thing we discussed at the start of the year, right, was commercial property in the US. So is there an argument to say that that might come under a bit of further scrutiny, maybe stress?
Personally, Miles, I do think it's changed those probabilities a little bit. We're unsure of how much, you know. So what you'd say overall is, look, the US consumer, the US private sector remains in pretty intimidatingly good health. Balance sheets are looking robust. There's not sort of masses of leverage in the system or masses of risky leverage. It doesn't feel like that anyway. But there are some spots, like you say. So within certain lower income households, you're seeing, you know, rise in delinquencies in things like auto loans and certain credit cards. And commercial property is another area where it's creaking. And there'll be others behind the scenes a little bit. The point would be is the longer interest rates remain at this level, the more those under pressure areas of the economy, pressured by that step change in interest rates, the more they should creak. Crack and groan.
Creaks turning into cracks, maybe.
Yes, creaks. Nice, you see? I told you you should do this on your own. And with regards to that, you know, it's going to be more difficult in things like commercial property. You know, the idea that creditors with a lot of these kind of debtors can kick the can down the road safe-ish in the knowledge that actually, although interest rates are high now, you can sort of say, well, look, you know, let's have a look at next year, how we can remanage that. That gets more difficult, kicking the can down the road if interest rates remain at that high level. So, you know, a more cynical way, you know, the extend and pretend idea starts to sort of, that's what people would worry about a little bit more. Yes, so the risk of a financial accident maybe increases if interest rates remain at these levels or inflation refuses to sort of suddenly go away. But I would say, yeah, it's difficult because the US economy has such forward momentum at the moment that part of the story here is also about, you know, maybe the US economy is just can digest higher interest rates, or the equilibrium, the strike point for interest rates is just higher because of all sorts of positive things. So in a way, being out of the market is potentially more painful in the context of that quite strong US economy.
So it's almost a case of treating it as innocent until proven guilty.
Yes.
Again, no, this, bit of a simplification.
Yes. But. No, you're right. To a degree. And you know, like, again, like the team and I, we're constantly monitoring these risks and how they evolve. And, you know, it's always, you know, Miles, you and I have had many conversations over many years in terms of, you know, at all sorts of, and what you tend to find is, you know, during an economic cycle, however long that is, you're going to have multiple false alarms. They look credible at the time, they look substantial, they're worrying, risky, you know, whether it's some aspect of poor lending risk, oh, well, whatever.
You know. When you look back in 2-3 years' time and it's almost forgotten about.
Yeah, and it's almost forgotten about. And most of the time, you know, there's high single digits of sort of, you know, 5-6 times where you look, ah, God, that looks real. Then there's one that really is a cycle killer, ultimately. You know, I'm oversimplifying a lot. But in this occasion, you know, quite a lot of the time you're left sort of saying, look, you know, the positives column for the economy just looks too big for that to really upset the apple cart. That's sometimes the answer you come to. I think still at the moment, that would be the way that we would view the US economy, because, you know, that US private sector health in aggregate is very strong. The employment backdrop looks still pretty robust, and we've had initial, you know, jobless claims today. Again, labor market remains strong. Wages are growing in real terms. Actually, you're finding that actually the, you know, bottom quintiles in terms of income distribution are enjoying the best real wage growth. So there's kind of quite a lot of good stuff going on alongside that productivity story, which is really important, I think. So
you've still got your glass half full.
Yes, just about.
And would you say it's a similar story? Obviously, the US, as you always say, you know, it sets the drumbeat for the global stage. Mm. Is it a similar case? Can you just extrapolate that into Europe, which, you know, we just had the ECB keep rates on hold again today, and the UK as well?
Europe and UK look very different. you know, obviously you're coming from a much more sluggish growth trajectory. Inflation still seems to be coming down pretty fast. I mean, we'll see with the next data. It now looks like Europe at least is going to be given the freedom to cut rates a little bit sooner than the US now on current view, you know, so June looks like that's what they were preparing the market for today. So yes, it looks very different. And the fascinating thing I think about the differences is some of these things hinge from how the governments behaved, acted in the pandemic, if you think about it. And there was one thing at the time, and I remember thinking about this, and you and I talked about this, but you know, when the pandemic came along and these economies kind of decided to shut down like massive nuclear reactors, you know, obviously what you had to do was to work out, well, you know, if I'm going to send everyone home, how do I keep them alive? You know, how do I stop the economy from just, you know, completely, jamming up just sort of cascading defaults and so on and so on, you know, a real depression, that kind of awful thing. And the answer in Europe was quite often to preserve labor market matches. And so companies kept employing people, but, you know, they put them on furlough and the government helped and sort of smoothed it all through. In the US, they accepted a very different mechanism, which was basically, unemployment went up like, I mean, unbelievable amounts in a short space of time. And we talked about it at the time about that unemployment chart. And it was breathtaking and super alarming. And what they did is they put checks in their pockets instead. Now, the interesting thing about how that's played out is you have found since then that the US labor market is a story of incredible success. So a lot of those people have come back into the labor market and actually as much in the lower income segments as any, and found better jobs where they seem to be better fits. And that's one of the arguments why productivity is lifted up, that actually what you found is that because you threw everything up in the air at a time of change anyway, because companies went away, they invested in quite a lot of software because of the pandemic, you've had this new technology come along. So at this time of seismic change, and also lots of these people went out and started their own business up. So you found a surge in business formation as well in the US. So suddenly the US economy, like all of that chaos, in a sense, or what appeared to be chaos, that's manifested as kind of greater dynamism to a degree.
Bit of a natural reshuffle.
Yes. You know, like we've talked about before, these are kind of choices to a degree amongst society about how much chaos you want to, you know, embrace. It's not easy. And it's not something you can just turn around and say, well, I want to be the US or I want to be Japan at the other end. You know, there's sort of genetic factors to do with economies about how they behave in these situations and the role of the state and how what workers expect and all those kind of things. But in this particular instance, it looks like the US, that extra dynamism is kind of paying off. So UK and Europe, I still think they're picking up a bit and you're seeing lead indicators improve and the manufacturing cycle is turning a bit better and consumers, you know, particularly in the Southern Europe, seem to be enjoying, you know, real wage gains and same in the UK. So, I mean, I think the future is a bit brighter than it has been for the UK and Europe, particularly in the context of that new technology. But it's very interesting.
Oh, it's a fascinating way to think about it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's been a fascinating and tragic period, you know, but yeah.
And then I suppose thinking about people listening today, particularly when you see all these headlines and all this attention grabbing stuff, there's this kind of natural urge, isn't there, to start tweaking portfolios around the edges to do something. Should investors be changing anything in their portfolios at the moment?
Well, Miles, I mean, you know,
not that we're giving advice, of course.
No, we're not giving advice, obviously not. I mean, I think the main thing that this reminds me of, in a way, is that there are many, 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 many potential futures ahead, always. And the breadth of those potential paths ahead is particularly wide at the moment. And not all of those futures, in fact, I would say a majority of them, do not extend in a straight line from the recent past. You know, so the winners and losers could look incredibly different from the decade or two running up to the pandemic, because we're looking at a very different world in a way. You know, this is not one where you can plausibly say that your main base scenario is that interest rates return to near zero and stay there, that inflation is going to be back to quiescent. Maybe it will, but I'm not sure that should be the majority view or the base case. Productivity has changed for a start, which means something totally different. So what it means is that from our investment standpoint, I think it's kind of a good reminder about why we as a business, spend so much time thinking about diversification, you know, mathematically imagining hundreds of thousands of different futures, thinking about how we can maximize resilience of the funds, as well as making sure that we're really well positioned to participate in terms of this industrial revolution coming in, but also that robustness about finding assets that do well in less good times and all those kind of things. So that core is important from a tactical asset allocation perspective. So we have had some relative value positions in, which have been quite good in this point, just to what you were describing there, that the sort of divergence of expectations with regards to US and Europe and the UK, that's been something that we've played successfully in the funds and portfolios on people's behalf. There are other bits which are sort of not working quite as well. In aggregate, it's all sort of doing okay, but it's prompted a bit of a debate just because of the extremity of the moves and sort of how interesting some of that data was. So we're on it.
Healthy debates.
Yes, yeah.
We're on it. And as you always say, that's just, of course, still having humility and tweaking around the edges rather than wholesale changes.
And Miles, you know, like these things are so instructive, these moments, because it's, again, a reminder, there's just too many strident voices in this industry. This is going to happen, that's going to happen. And again, like we would reiterate that stridency to any answer or any question on where inflation is going to go is an automatic sign to stop listening.
Yeah. And on that note,
inflation's going to be 2.3, but yeah.
Brilliant stuff. Look, we'll wrap it up there. Very useful as always. And we will catch you again next week.
All investments can fall as well as rise in value, and their past performance is not a reliable indicator of future performance. This podcast is not a personal investment recommendation.